York that year like overstayed houseguests. He spread a blanket, some quilted monstrosity he nabbed from Fishing Lake. We opened it out on the grass under the trees that dipped low to the ground, shrouding us, and we kissed. In public. That amazes me now. Henry kissing in public is like saying, gentle grizzly bear. There's no fitting mental image. I wore a navy blue dress he'd bought me, brandishing it as though it were from the Queen Mum herself. It cinched at the waist with a wide belt and an A-line skirt, and reminded me of something I'd seen in an old Life magazine, a black-and-white ad for cream deodorant. Are you really lovely to love? Henry's eyes crinkled at the corners when he smiled. I was drunk on his love, his hands, the line of muscle from his neck down to his shoulder blade, the small scar above his eyebrow, the freckle in the hollow of his ear. I wanted to memorize him. We'd only been dating a short time, and yet, by all accounts, I was becoming a contender for a fascinating person, capital F, capital P. One of a few women who were taming the wild beasts that were New York City's most eligible men. "I'm going to marry you, Zoe Swanson," he'd whispered as his fingers danced up my thigh. "Are you now? Will you at least ask me?" I teased, biting at his bottom lip.
"I'd never give you the chance to say no."
"Oh, bless my stars!" I toyed with his hair, my voice a thick, syrupy accent. "Who would ever say no to Henry Whittaker?"
"My first wife. She said no. Twice, actually."
I sat up, pushing his hand off my leg. "You're what?"
"I was married before. You didn't know?"
Henry had a way of phrasing things, just so, to delicately pass off blame, as though I should have been able to glean this information out of his inky black silence, blood from a stone. "No, I'm pretty sure I'd remember that." I pulled my knees up to my chest and hugged them. "What happened? Is there an ex-Mrs. Whittaker slowly funneling all your money?" A thought occurred to me. "Oh my God, Henry, is there a Henry Jr.? I can't be a stepmother. I mean, I guess I could be, but I don't know how to be." He pulled my arms away from my knees and kissed my palms one at a time. His lips were soft, slightly greasy like our old chapstick.
"There's no Henry Jr. My wife, she died in a car accident 3 years ago."
Henry lived in the abrupt. "What? How? What was her name? Oh, God, Henry, that's terrible." My heart had thudded in my chest.
"Her name was Tara. We were driving home from a dinner. The next thing I know, we're at the hospital and the doctors are talking about life support and feeding tubes. And that was it. It was over, and 24 hours later I was a widower. Married one minute, the next, not. It's so strange how life can happen that way."
"What happened?"
"Oh, details. I'll tell you one day."
He kissed me full on the mouth, his breath coming in huffs, his hands gripping my waist as though he were drowning. He needs me now, I'd thought at the time. Still think, sometimes. But then, he never did tell me. I've broached the subject on any number of occasions. It's the wrong time, later, I'm tired, the excuses are endless. I have periodically pushed the issue. His stalwart chin sticking out as he shakes his head, disappointed. My phone vibrates in my hand. I somehow manage to answer it without breathing.
"Can you come Friday? I'll give you an hour."
Chapter 15. I leave Washington Square and hop on the F train at the West 4th Street station. The subway is mostly empty because it is 2 o'clock on a Monday. In April, people walk. They've been confined to subways and cabs for 4 months, so come spring, the sidewalks flood with people. No distance is too long. A lone violinist hunkers down in front of the subway door, his bow crying a haunting melody that I don't recognize. The upturned baseball hat at his feet is empty. When the brakes squeal at 23rd Street, I bend down and fold $2 behind the brim. He gives me a watery smile and returns to his swaying. Once I emerge on street level, I join the throng of moving people and walk north for 5 blocks until I reach Manhattan's Flower District. The street is filled with tall green trees, grass, even a large tilting palm potted in thick black plastic, its fronds cupping the hood of a Lincoln Town Car. The Jungle Street, we always called it. The macadam is wet from the misters, the damp pavement and lush greens providing a unique perfume. The early morning rush has dissipated, leaving only the workers, the warehouse movers, designers, shop owners, and a few passers-through. I hesitate outside the door, just long enough for Javi to spot me and whistle. His fishnet shirt is pulled tight against his bulging chest, and he's paired it with white cutoffs and a pair of nude patent leather high heels. He slinks like a cat, and when he smiles, I can almost see the canary caught and fluttering between his pointed teeth. I roll my eyes and straighten my back. Some ribbing will come.
"Well, well, I hardly recognize you, Coapa."
He tisks at me and then calls over his shoulder, "Elisa! Elisa!" When she appears in the doorway, she's wiping her hands on a black work towel that is clipped to her waist. Her blonde hair is streaked with white and secured with an oversized blue bow. She hovers in the doorway, framed by protruding pink orchids and purple lisianthus. A 60-year-old Alice in Wonderland. She steps aside and motions me into the shop.
"Zoe, Lydia said you'd come. I didn't believe her."
Elisa has one tone, clipped. Her diction always seemed slightly Eastern European to me, but years ago she had family come to visit from Texas, and Lydia swore they'd said she'd grown up there.
"Elisa," I breathe out, "I'm in her world now. This woman, who had on occasion reduced me to tears because the hydrangeas were not precisely the blue she'd had in mind.
An image comes to mind of late nights in the warehouse, pulling leaves and bleeding as she towers over me, clucking with soft disapproval. She straightens to her full 5 feet, her childlike hands patting down her pockets like she's forgotten something. Soft, thin lines pucker around delicately painted petal pink lips. A pair of butterfly glasses balances on the bridge of her nose.
"Are you back to work?"
"Not today." I don't feel as confident as I pretend, but she nods, conceding. It's the first time I can ever remember controlling the conversation. Today is a visit of sorts. "Is Lydia in?"
"She is. We are starting to prepare for the Crable wedding."
She twirls a headless stem in her fingers, studying me. I shift my purse from one shoulder to the other and pretend to study the industrial shelving lining the walls. It's new. "Crable?" I cock my head to the side. "Norman?"
"His daughter, Sophie."
I didn't know he had a daughter. Come to think of it, he likely has several and possibly some he doesn't even know about. She grins, all Cheshire Cat.
"I am surprised you are not invited."
She clucks, and just like that, I'm reduced again. An outsider for life, an observer of certain circles, not a participant. Elisa with her award-winning designs and sought-after events, Henry with his charisma, a fat checkbook, and fluid pen. The Saturday after Henry proposed, I had fled to the shop at 6 a.m., breathless and heady, in the clothes I'd worn the day before, my hair matted and bed-tousled, smelling of Henry's cologne and the warm, soft, slight musk of sex. "I'm engaged!" I flashed my hand in front of Lydia's face, and Javi snatched my finger, turning it one way, then the other, whistling at the size of the diamond. We all squealed and jumped up and down because of Henry Whittaker. "Zoe Whittaker is the most elegant name I've ever heard." Javi jutted out a hip and glided around the shop, twirling a make-believe train in his hand. "You gotta act the part now, bitch. You are not cut out for grace like that. Look at your face. I see 3 holes, not including that big-ass mouth. What is that fine man thinking?" He pointed his long filed nails at my eyebrow ring, my lip ring, and my nose stud, and held up 3 fingers. Lydia threw a bucket of clippings at him. "Shut up, Javi. You're just jealous."
"Who is jealous of whom?" Elisa stood between the shop and the warehouse, her sleeves rolled up.
Henry asked Zoe to marry him,
Lydia supplied, and there was a beat of silence.
Henry Whittaker.
Elisa shifted a bucket of blooms from one hip to the other. Engaged.
New York's most eligible bachelor is no longer, Lydia sing-songed.
Elisa onced me over, head to toe, and then crooked her finger.
Come with me,
she pointed at Lydia and Javi.
You two, stay.
I had followed her into the warehouse, a wide-open, seemingly endless bay of stainless steel and concrete used to assemble millions of dollars worth of arrangements a year. Elisa plunked the bucket onto one of the long tables and turned to face me.
Your courtship was what? A month?
Almost four.
I had 5 inches on Elisa and I used them. My chin hovered around her forehead.
That is nothing. You know nothing about each other. Henry is a complicated man, Zoe. I don't know him well, but I've known him for a few years now. He wants a wife. He's made no bones about that.
He loves me. I had meant it to sound strong, but it dribbled out like weak spittle.
You have talent. You have a future here. Do you know that?
Her voice was soft but stern, her eyes over the brim of her glasses flared. I'm not going anywhere, Elisa.
You say that now. Henry's wife will not work as someone he himself could hire. These people, they don't operate like that.
You have Nolan.
Elisa's partner for the past 30 years was wealthy, in real estate. Prior to Henry, dating him, loving him, I'd never tried to attract men from these circles. Too high profile, too public. Henry, with long, strong hands, veined and powerful, molded me into someone new, like putty.
Nolan is not in the same league as the likes of Henry Whittaker. Believe me, you've been to their parties, their benefits, their galas. It's a pretend world, Zoe. All diamond and glitter facade.
She moved closer to me, her breath hot on my face, her fingers wrapped around my bicep.
Made of glass, and just as fragile.
I love it here, okay? I'd shaken my arm out of her grasp and she'd stepped back, shaking her head.
Don't lose you.
She stared at me, her eyes slits above the top of her glasses.
Who was that, exactly?
She'd patted her hair back into place and huffed to the back of the room. Henry and I married 3 months later. Shortly after that, I'd quit to travel the world, believing that the choices I was making had no repercussions, that my leaving would affect no one but me. Now Elisa is poised in front of me, a reminder that she is forever right. I am back to grovel for my position. Javi bounces back and forth on the balls of his feet in barely contained joy, his head bouncing back and forth between us like he's about to witness a fight. She points him to the back room and inside the small shop front, points to a chair.
Sit.
Javi shuffles through the metal double doors, and I'd bet my wedding ring he's hovering, ear pressed to the crack between them. The storefront is barely a store. It doesn't serve to walk-ins, just by appointment only. It contains a desk and a large glass front cooler. You can order small bouquets, exotic arrangements, mostly cast-offs. If you know Elisa, she'll make you anything. If you don't, she'll turn the door sign. She busies herself pulling together blooms by color as they arrive to the warehouse bundled by type and color.
You haven't been gone so long?
Creamy peach roses mingle with apricot tulips and I close my eyes, taking a deep breath.
I have no qualms with welcoming you back, Zoe. You've always shown huge promise as a designer. You have an impeccable eye for incorporating modern trends with classic looks.
I nod. I've never gotten a compliment like this from Elisa. Ever, ever. Wait until I tell Lydia, if she still even cares. I can't believe I had to wait until I was no longer working there to hear it. I can hear Javi singing, his berry white voice echoing off the concrete walls. I hear other voices, employees I no longer recognize, hired to process, leaving the design work to Elisa and Lydia.
I know from experience that they've been at it since the wee hours of the morning. Weeks of large events, celebrity weddings, city galas, and once a mayoral ball, the day starts at 3 a.m.
What I'd like to know, Elisa continues in her even flat voice, is why now? Why will Henry let you come back now? Will you just up and leave again when he says so?
Henry never asked me to quit. That was my idea, I interject. It's a true statement. We'd been traveling, sometimes weeks at a time. Paris, Rome, Madrid. Henry wanted to show me the world, and it was impossible to keep a schedule.
Was I supposed to just tell him no? Madrid can wait. We have the banker's ball.
I had done things. I heard Ave Maria performed by a 100-member a cappella choir in the Pantheon. I'd met the Pope, shaken his wizened hand, his eyes kind behind papery, lashless eyelids. Yes, I'd given up my little job in a fancy flower shop. No, I no longer dyed my hair fuchsia and purple. Were people not allowed to grow?
People change, Elisa. I'm young. I had an opportunity to do something with my life outside of this city. When we came back, I decided to use my newfound money for something good and got involved in care. I'm allowed to do these things. Not you or Henry can change that.
Elisa pulls out a large bundle of yellow roses, and mumbling to herself, she throws them in the large green plastic trash bucket.
Is it your life, Zoe? All I ask is that you make sure of that.
She waves me away, back toward the warehouse where I can hear a boombox blasting, Respect. I hold up my hand, palm out, tired of her cryptic morality messages. The warehouse is overwhelmed with color, an overabundance of light pink. I spot Lydia in the corner, instructing a small dark-haired woman on what to look for in a bloom. The girl is nodding and fidgeting with her apron string. Lydia sees me and flashes me a grin, nodding in Javi's direction. I shake my head. She motions to the girl, who nods and continues to strip leaves, slicing the stems on a bias with a sharp knife. She stops every few minutes to examine her thumb. I look at my own thumb, the skin still tough and lined with the fine, delicate scars. I run my index finger over the pad and feel the healed incisions. When I flip my hands over, palms down, the skin on the top is newly smooth and creamy, groomed by manicures and coddled with expensive lotions.
I don't think it's even possible to cut my skin anymore. It has to be made of leather by now.
Lydia stands in front of me, her eyes bright and blinking, her mouth curved in a genuine smile. Gone are the double entendres and chilly pretenses from last week. She radiates warmth. I remember why I'm there.
Can we talk somewhere he's not? I jerk my head in Javi's direction.
He's giving me the stink eye from across the room, whispering to one of the warehouse runners behind his hand, laughing in my direction.
What is his deal?
Lydia shrugs and rolls her eyes.
You know Javi. He's just a pain in the ass. He thinks you abandoned us. He's wrapped his own insecurities around you, thinks that you think you're better than us.
I did come back. I have come back to say hi. I was on a trip. For months.
What the hell, Lyd? She leans me to a corner in the front of the warehouse and gives me a metal folding chair. We both sit so our knees are touching. Her foot bobs, and I know she wants a cigarette, but when Elisa lurks around, you can't just simply take a smoke break. I remember the drill. You wait for an errand you can conveniently volunteer for, otherwise Elisa's eyes dart around like an eagle performing a constant head count.
Come on, you know him. He's got a stick up his ass. He thinks you're a richy rich now, all judgy of his wardrobe, that you're too good for his scene. I don't know why.
I cut her off because I can't keep it in anymore. I found her. Lydia, I found my mother.
I reach out and grab her shoulders without even realizing it, and she looks startled.
Wait, what?
I found my birth mother. She agreed to see me Friday. I got Cash, this reporter I've weirdly become friends with, to take me. Can you come with us?
I throw it out there, reckless and unplanned. I suddenly want a guard wall of friends.
I can't. It's Sissy's birthday.
Sissy is Lydia's mom, a freckled blonde version of Lydia, their faces identical. When I met her in the kitchen of Lydia's childhood home in Woodbridge, New Jersey, surrounded by rooster decorations and rustic signs painted with things like fresh eggs and home of the free, star, because of the brave, she'd just baked a pie. She wiped her hands on an apple apron and handed me a homemade chocolate chip cookie from a mooing cow cookie jar. Lydia always took umbrage with her childhood. It had been too happy to retain any sort of street cred, despite her piercings and tattoos. Sissy never batted an eyelash at her punk daughter, her full, fleshy arms wobbling as she hugged both of us at once, as though I was somehow included too. She smelled like Jean Nate. "Tell her. See if she cares." I persist, because now that I've told her, now that I've let Lydia in again, I want to share everything with her. I've been friendship-starved, and now I want the all-you-can-eat 24-hour buffet.
"God, she'll want to come."
Lydia curls her lip.
"I can't. We're going out to dinner, probably to the Golden Corral or something."
She can hardly stand the provinciality. She pulls my hand up to her face and studies my French manicure.
"You'll cut these, you know."
Little more than a year before, my nails were clipped down to the beds, raggedy and hangnailed. "I know. I'm ready for it. I want to come back. I want to be back."
"And Henry says..."
"He's fine with it. He wants me to be happy."
"Will he let you come back every day?"
She arches one penciled eyebrow at me, toeing my shin with a black original Chuck Taylor. "That's a trick question. I don't want to come back every day." I'm pretty sure that's true. I stand up abruptly, dusting imaginary crumbs off my slacks. I'm pretty sure Lydia has never worn slacks in her life. But still, "as you are woman, so be lovely," darts across my mind.
"Are you leaving?"
The snotty tone is back with an unspoken, "I told you so." "Yeah. I want to be home for Henry." I say this defiantly, daring her to make a snotty comment. Instead, she stands and gives me a hug.
"Good luck, Friday. Call me as soon as you leave. I'll be waiting by the phone."
I rest my cheek on her pointed shoulder, the tool of her shirt scratching my skin, and breathe in her Lydia-ness. Patchouli and some kind of herbal hairspray. I forgot about having someone to call as soon as you were done. Henry could schedule a call down to the minute, but I could never call him as soon as I left anything. That was a girlfriend station, someone to dial as you were leaving a doctor's office to tell her the sunspot was nothing, or send a picture of a new haircut, or text as soon as you got the job with lots of exclamations and smiley faces. The back of my brain skitters on the thought that maybe Caroline could be this person. I know what Cash said, and it has merit. But who's to say we couldn't be friends? I promise to call and give a quick flitted finger wave in Elisa's direction, who raises her chin and sniffs back at me, which is as good as I was likely to get. I didn't bother going back into the warehouse, preferring instead to duck out unnoticed.
"See ya in a year,"
Javi's deep echo follows me out, chased by a chittering of laughter echoing off the steel walls of the warehouse. Chapter 16. The spread is not only above the fold, but spans two whole pages in the living section. Cash managed to hunt down and interview the board president of CARE, and true to his word, the piece is entirely devoted to the charity. The event itself, a small subset of the entire article, was brilliantly tacked on at the beginning and the end to keep it in both the living and entertainment pages. He highlighted the organization's purpose, our triumphs, where we're lacking, what we specifically need funding for, our scholarship program, propelled by Amanda Natiz, and some of the other success stories. I've been working on developing a program to improve book distribution in the city's public schools, but I haven't given it much thought in the past few days. Admittedly, the whole Caroline thing has taken up residence in my brain, edging out all else. I smooth the crease of the page flat with my index finger and wipe the ink on a dish towel. I'm perched at the kitchen island waiting for Henry. The apartment is restored, the break-in erased with a deft hand, The fingerprint powder scrubbed clean. The slashed sofa has been replaced. It's not an exact replica, but a shade darker, a bit rounder and puffier. I wonder if there were surreptitious conversations about the sofa.
I'd like it to be just the exact same size.
Can it be slightly larger? It's only slightly.
Does she beg? Does she plead for Henry to accept her suggestions? Who holds the power between them? I can't figure it out. Does Henry keep these conversations away from me purposefully? If I asked him, he'd say no. That he just has them at work. They're minutia, he'd say. Pat my hand. Penny has left a tapas plate of brie and olives to rest on the counter, and the apartment is heavy with the aroma of braised lamb. I pinch an olive and pop it in my mouth. Because it is Wednesday, Henry will have had a light lunch, takeout from the catered delivery service at the office. Wednesdays are beef and lamb days. My stomach rumbles and I lick my thumb and turn the page. There is one photograph of me. The camera is behind me, and I am talking to Sophia Reston, a B-list celebrity who was famous in the 90s for her antics as a spoiled heiress, but who has become active in and supportive of the city's charities. She attends almost all the care benefits with a different guest, someone with a large checkbook and the desire to impress his date. Our heads are bent together, and we're both smiling, but my features are barely distinguishable, in profile. I nod slowly and exhale. It's a good piece, focusing on the influence of the cause and how it has helped thousands of system kids graduate from high school, trade school, and sometimes college. The college graduates always come back. I hear the elevator doors swoosh open in the hallway. Henry comes through the front door, dusting off the sleeves of his suit, his mouth tipped in a half grimace. Hi! I stand in his path, raised on my toes to kiss him, and he blinks twice like he's forgotten who I am. He then leans forward and kisses me, distracted, perfunctory.
This goddamn city drives me crazy. I can't go 2 blocks without walking under scaffolding and getting covered in sawdust.
I study his suit and see nothing. I shake my head with a little smile just to see how easy it will be to break his mood. He stops and smiles back at me.
I'm a grump. I'm sorry. I've spent most of the day arguing.
I tug on his hand. Come, look at this. In the kitchen, we pick at cheese and I fan the paper out in front of him. He reads it, nodding thoughtfully, his fingers tapping gently against the countertop. The bottom half of the second page is devoted to the event, and as his eyes travel down the page, his fingers stop tapping and he frowns. What?
I don't know, Zoe. This guy, what's his name?
Cash? I square my shoulders.
He seems very interested in you.
I snatch the paper from his hand. What are you talking about? This was my event. Of course I'm featured heavily.
A lot of quotes from you, that's all. I have a feeling you were a big influence in the entire write-up. Maybe he talked to other people, but all of this about the scholarships and the school books, these are things I've heard you mention.
Well, he did talk to me. That should be fine. The story is what's important. I can feel my hackles rising, my chin jutting out.
And this picture? It's practically a 70s smoking ad. You're all curves and seduction.
You can't even see my face.
Exactly. Just your bare back, a glimmer of shoulder, long sexy hair, and a hint of a smile in profile.
I can feel my mood plummeting. It's not like that, Henry. This is what I wanted. I shake the paper at him. This is a good thing. Why is it always like this with you? You're so afraid to be happy, you automatically jump to the negative. Just be happy for me.
I'm happy for you. It's a decent article as far as newspapers these days go. Reporting isn't what it used to be.
He shrugs. The oven timer goes off, and I toss the newspaper back onto the countertop and stalk to the kitchen. I hear him snap the pages back open. In the kitchen, I remove the lamb, prep the plates, the china clattering off marble, the silverware tinny, making as big a racket as I can. Henry hates plate clanging. We'll sit in the dining room with our lamb and salad and pesto orzo prepared by Penny but served by me. I've complained a few times that I can't handle being served dinner. Penny hovering like a skitsy bird over our chairs, ostensibly to see if we need anything, but, to my mind, just plain old-fashioned eavesdropping. I can't handle her light feather touches to Henry's shoulder, and yet her eyes dart around when I speak to her as though she's channeling an apparition. She squints in my direction, though not so much at me. Though she is never outright rude, I need to feel comfortable dining in my own home. I carry the plates to the dining room where Henry has brought the paper with him. He jangles ice in a whiskey glass as he studies the print over the top of his reading glasses. I can't help but think that he looks sexy even when I'm exasperated with him. "Who did you argue with today?" I set his plate in front of him, lightly scratching his neck, expecting him to do what he usually does when he's unreasonable or childish, which is offer me an impish smile and some vague overreaching flattery. But he does none of those things.
"How many times did you meet with this man, Zoe?"
I sit carefully in the chair to Henry's right, concentrating on unfolding the napkin in my lap. Half of me flares up. How dare he ask? How dare he care? I'm free to talk to whomever I'd like. This is hardly the 50s. 3. I spear a piece of lamb. The tender meat falls apart. A perfect doneness. Sometimes I'd like her to, just once, burn a meal, overestimate the cooking time. It hasn't happened yet.
"Yet you've said nothing. I ask you about your daily activities. You've remained vague. Why?"
I tip my wine glass and swallow it all down at once like a nervous freshman at a fraternity party. "Not purposefully. They've all been brief. I'm sure whatever else I did that day was more interesting."
"Your entire day is interesting to me, Zoe. You know that. Why would you lie? Why would you cover it up?"
"I'm not covering it up, Henry. This whole conversation is ridiculous. We met 3 times in public places, discussed the charity, my involvement. That's it. Enough of this." I stand, planning to get another glass of wine.
"Sit,"
he commands in his boardroom voice, the one no one dares defy. I ease myself back down in my chair. "As you are woman, so be lovely. And obedient?"
"I can't tolerate the lying, even by omission. If it was no big deal, then why not tell me?"
He scans the paper, pointing one buffed manicured nail to a sentence. "Zoe Whittaker is personally attached to the cause of helping orphans and those left to fend for themselves because she relates to the isolation."
"You've been personal with this man. This is an intimate conversation."
Stab at the paper again, this time at the picture.
"This is an intimate photograph."
I see the picture through Henry's eyes, the long curve of my spine, a sly, sexy smile, one delicately arched eyebrow. My hand floats near my ear, where I have just tucked a lock of hair. I sigh heavily. Stupid is what it is. "Henry, I will not have this conversation."
"This man has feelings for you. If you were not aware of it, you wouldn't have lied to me."
"I never lied to you," I protest sharply. "I just wasn't willing to be monitored."
"Bullshit."
His voice is loud now and he stands up, his palms bracing against the table.
"You have feelings for him too? That low-life barely reporter who makes $30,000 a year and lives in a one-room apartment in the East Village, where all the hippies and the druggies hang out?"
I gape up at him. I never told Henry where Cash lived.
"I know everything about him, Zoe. He's involved in my life now. I need to know these things. Do you think I'm haphazard? Do you think I can afford to just let people in? I will not let my life, my wife, be compromised in that way."
He's practically yelling. Even his hair has taken on an unusually disheveled appearance. "Henry, are you insane?" I spit. He leans close to me, his eyes flashing. Small dots of white spittle have foamed the corners of his mouth.
"Zoe, do not question me about this. I will know what you are doing. I will know who you are spending time with. I will know."
My heart races. I've never seen Henry angry. Not like this. Cold, calculating, yes. Not this wild rage. My hands shake, and I mentally swing between wanting to fire back at him and calming him down. "Henry, I can't live like this. Under your rules, your roof, your thumb, your..." He's so quick,
I hear the glass shatter before I realize what he's done. The smell of whiskey stings my nostrils and pierces the back of my throat. The wall behind me drips brown amber liquid. His voice is low, hard, and barely controlled.
Then get out.
He spins around and is gone. I don't get out. Where would I go? Lydia's? I could hear the "I told you so" out of the side of her mouth, lips twisted in a smirk. Or worse, if she reacted with pity, like I was seeking refuge at some kind of abused women's shelter. No. In the end, I stay in the apartment. Henry's office door is closed, and I wonder if that's where he'll sleep. The room has a long black leather sofa, and once or twice when he's been working late, he has slept in there. Never out of anger. That would be a first. Isn't sleeping on the couch a sitcom staple? Pillows flying down the stairs and a hapless, balding, middle-aged man scrambling to catch them. Linda, please, I'll take out the garbage. These are normal married people things. Truthfully, I have no idea what normal married couples are like, outside of movies and television. I've never witnessed it. I think of Evelyn, pre-cancer, with her thick, dark hair, red string bikini, and cut-off jean shorts in the driver's seat of a borrowed black convertible, blasting Bruce Springsteen all the way down the Pacific Coast Highway to Capitola Beach. She'd spread blankets, twist and heave a heavy umbrella into the ground, and sit, smoking cigarettes and humming softly under her breath while I dug holes in the sand. We need a radio, Bud, don't you think? I loved Bud. She never called me darling or sweetie. She and I were pals, united against the world. I was 12, edging into teenage angst while reaching back to my mom, my Bud, with one hand. I'll find us one. I shrugged because I was collecting baby crabs, their soft gray bodies scuttling up the sides of the yellow bucket and sliding back into the mush at the bottom. The wind picked up, my hair whipping around like sandy cattails, slapping at my eyes. I eyed the girl on the blanket next to us, her hair pulled back taut against her head and held in place with a hairband. Evelyn never had a hairband with her in her life, I was pretty sure. She wasn't a band-aid-in-every-pocketbook kind of mother. Evelyn screamed when the umbrella uprooted and skipped dangerously across the sand toward the ocean. Beachgoers shouted, pointed, and ducked, but no one jumped up. She stood helplessly and watched our only beach umbrella pinwheel away. She flopped back onto the blanket and gave me a dazzling smile, all sparkling teeth, and shrugged like it didn't matter. Like we could just buy another one, which of course I knew we couldn't. I squinted down the beach, but the umbrella was gone. I went back to my digging, scooting down toward the wet sand, but she never called me back. When I wandered back up to the blanket, a man sat next to Evelyn, his chest tan and shiny, his dark hair slick. "Bud, look! This nice man here brought our umbrella back." She rubbed his bicep.
"Hi, Hillary. Your mom was just talking about you. I'm Michael, but people call me Mick."
"Not Mike?" There was a Michael in Mrs. Hoppett's sixth grade class, but everyone called him Mike.
"Nope. Mick. It's Irish."
He didn't look Irish. Mick hung around all day, anchoring the umbrella deep into the sand, and I was relieved we wouldn't have to buy another one. I hated buying stuff with Evelyn. She'd walk it to the counter, hesitate until the cashier huffed, and she'd put it back. It was embarrassing. Back in our apartment, Evelyn made dinner and Mick stayed. When I woke up the next day, he was perched at the breakfast table while Evelyn hummed over a pan of fried eggs. When I got home from school, he was reclined on the couch, reading Evelyn's newspaper that I was never supposed to touch because it was her only luxury. His dirty sneakers rested on the armrest.
"Hey, Bud," he said,
and I said nothing because we were not buds. He stayed for quite a while, his big hands around her shoulders as we watched baseball at night instead of our usual Golden Girls reruns. I tried to protest, but Evelyn smiled and patted my knee and kissed Mick's cheek. He stayed through Evelyn's birthday, which was in October, and right up to Halloween. I had wanted to be a hippie,
but Evelyn forgot to make me a costume, so I was a scarecrow again, my outfit from the year before recycled. The jeans with the hay hems were too small, so we just left them unbuttoned. When Evelyn and I came back from trick-or-treating, Mick wasn't there. The next morning, he wasn't at the breakfast table or hogging the bathroom, filling it with steam and stink. And Evelyn's face was red, and her eyes were half closed. I knew she'd been crying. Then, a week later, he still hadn't come back, and I was flopped in her room watching her get ready for work after school. She stood facing her closet, wearing just her bra, her hands resting delicately on her hip bones as her foot tapped impatiently. She was searching for her uniform, a starchy maroon and white thing. One of her jobs at the time was as a hotel maid working early mornings.
"What's that?"
I pointed to her arm, yellow speckled dots, four of them in a row, like thumbprints in icing. She looked casually and ran her index finger over the smooth vanilla skin of her bicep and shrugged.
"Oh, I must have bumped into something."
But she turned away from me and put on her uniform real quick after that. Only later, when I was a teenager, she'd tell me how hard it was to find a good man. I'd remember Mick and think, he was not a good man. Sometimes he'd come back, then disappear for long stretches, leaving her to cry alone in her room, long into the nights. I'd asked her once if my father was a good man. She'd laughed, always, that tinkling soft giggle.
Only the best.
I swore I'd never be like her. The preening, making it all just so, promising this time would be different. I hated to see her weak, could hardly stand it. Once I started college, I'd catalog the boys I met. Good men and not good men. Sometimes it was easy to tell the difference. The not good men would drink and paw at me, pulling on my jean shorts in dark corners of fraternity parties. If Evelyn had met Henry before she died, she would have clapped her small hands together and sighed.
"Oh, you found one."
Evelyn was easily charmed, and Henry's favorite pastime was being charming. I think of Henry now, and his gentle smile, his eyes crinkled in the corners as he humors me, the way only I can make him laugh, the way he checks up on me, worries about me, frets and fusses like a finicky cat, his soft, careful hands on my body, his mouth on mine. The way he gives me the last piece of lobster, always. How he brings me gifts, small trinkets, flowers, a keychain, because he just can't stop thinking about me. He's nearly perfect. But is he good?
Chapter 17.
I lurk near a potted plant, my hair tucked back into a baseball cap that I found in the bottom of our closet. Dusty and faded. I've never seen it on Henry. The gym buzzes with people entering one door in business suits with briefcases and attachés, exiting through another in spandex and lycra, as though on a conveyor belt. I hover behind the one-way mirrored wall. I can see in. No one can see out. I scan the lobby. I'm semi-protected, but nowhere near invisible. I have maybe 5 minutes. To see what? Hard to say. Henry jogs on the treadmill, his cool-down pace, and on the machine next to him, the pink spandexed blonde keeps pace as they laugh. He's gesturing with his hands, and he throws his arms wide for the punchline. The blonde tosses her head back, laughing, and then stumbles, grabs at the safety bar. A sharp pain stabs my center, and I grit my teeth. They both slow and step off. Henry towels the back of his neck and watches her while she pulls up one leg, then the other in a post-workout stretch. I know this is crazy. I'm spying on my husband. I've become a suburban cliché, minus the 20 pounds of baby weight and minivan. His behavior has been so erratic. And this woman, his hand on her behind, against a backdrop of pink lycra, has become a mental picture my mind hands me at inopportune moments. Henry and I have always talked about partnership, working together to make things work. He's always said he'd never divorce, that divorced rich men are inevitably poor men, that any marriage can be fixed, that love fluctuates. His viewpoint, while coldly practical, was one of the reasons I married him so quickly. A 4-month courtship, a simple but elegant wedding, an expensive dinner party, and voila, a cemented spot in high society. Henry with his beautiful, charming wife, me with my handsome, rich husband.
Illusions are dangerous, said Evelyn.
Yet I have no illusions about marriage, no expectations of handsome princes and white horses and happily ever afters. Evelyn never believed in happily ever afters, warning against falling in love with an idea over a person.
Ideas are infallible. People are not. Don't confuse the two.
She was an optimist, but never naive. There's a difference, she'd say. So here I sit, next to a remarkably lifelike ficus tree, wondering if I've done just that. Is this an affair, or a harmless way to pass a grueling workout? He walks by her and flicks her hair like he's a third grader at recess. It's the playfulness that's so foreign.
Zoe?
I spin around, my heart in my throat. Reed Pinkman stands in front of me with his head cocked. I hardly recognize him outside Henry's office. Reed is younger than me, in his late 20s, ambitious and single, and often lightly flirtatious. Henry is his mentor and fawns over him. I'm always slightly embarrassed around Reed, ever since the night before Musha Key when Henry was cruel and Reed witnessed it. He's never brought it up, thankfully.
Hi, Reed, I say brightly, giving him a dazzling smile.
What are you doing here?
It's ironic, given my circumstances, that I don't actually enjoy inventing lies on the spot. My mind races and my heart thunders in my ears. I'm surprising Henry. Well, I was going to, but I just got an urgent call from a friend and I have to run. I glance back through the one-way glass and Henry has the gym towel tossed over his shoulder and he and blonde spandex are walking toward the door, but slowly. She touches his arm and he leans down to hear something she says. Reed follows my gaze and nods.
Ah, okay, then will I see you tonight?
My head snaps back to Reed.
Wait, what's tonight?
Reed looks toward Henry, who has stopped walking. Henry and the woman are now involved in deep, serious conversation, and Henry rakes a hand through his hair. The blonde crosses her arms over her chest and juts her chin out, and I'm struck with the thought that you don't typically get mad at someone you barely know. Anger is an intimate emotion.
The firm's celebration for Nippon. The Japanese steel account? Henry didn't tell you?
I'm sure he did. I probably forgot. I pull the hat off and shove it in my purse. Do me a favor, Reed. Don't tell Henry I was here, okay?
Sure thing.
He touches my arm and says hopefully,
see you tonight?
Yep, see you tonight. I rush into the revolving door just as Henry and the blonde come through the door into the lobby. They are stopped by Reed, and I use the opportunity to scuttle through one revolution before I'm spit out onto the sidewalk. Around the corner, I lean against the stone building under the concrete plaque with the number 58 on it, and take deep breaths. Who is the blonde? Does Reed know her? This is Reed's gym, too. If Henry was having an affair, Reed would most likely know about it. I have to figure out a way to get to tonight's event. I wonder if I can call Henry's secretary and ask where it is. My skin buzzes hot. It's a warm day for April, probably pushing 80 degrees, and my shirt sticks to my back. On a whim, I pull out my phone. Lunch? I text.
Starving, Cash texts back.
We arrange to meet in 10 minutes at a Black and Bean, a coffee shop a block away. I know we need to talk to make plans for tomorrow.
Tomorrow. And my stomach flips.
I haven't talked to him since Monday in the park when he agreed to go to Caroline's with me. I still haven't told Henry about Caroline. After last night and this morning, I'm not sure I will. My mind swims with unmade decisions and doubt. My ears ring with the sound of broken glass shattering on the wall behind me, crunching under my shoes. The stench of whiskey, the air permeated with violence. I might be overreacting. He didn't throw the glass at me. He threw it at the wall. Is that different?
Women have girlfriends for this very reason, to bounce their irrationalities off each other. I long for Lydia the way we used to be, non-judgmental and totally accepting. She once slept with two different men in the same night, and when she'd confessed it the next day, lying in our side-by-side beds with the late afternoon sun filtering through the smoky haze of our bedroom, I remember sitting straight up in bed, my mouth hanging open. Her choices were not my choices, and all I'd ever said was, "Who was better?" And we howled with laughter. As far as I could tell, she never stopped to question herself when she passed judgment on me. It hardly seemed fair. When we'd met, I'd been staying at a homeless shelter, wearing third and fourth-hand suits to job interviews that I was neither qualified for nor eligible to work, having not had a valid identification, a college education, or a permanent address. I wandered, exhausted, into La Fleur de Lys and sat helplessly on a chair, clutching the help wanted ads from the treasure hunt.
"What the hell is wrong with you?"
The girl had snapped her gum in my direction.
"Also, your clothes look like shit. When did you last go shopping, 1992?
Do you always greet people this way?" I sat up straight, studying her pink and purple-tipped hair, the large curling tattoo on her wispy upper arm, her blood-red lipstick.
"Most of the time. Do you always wear suits to interview for custodial positions?"
"Custodial? I thought it said florist assistant."
"You're basically pushing a broom, sister. Do you think you can handle that?"
She studied the paper in front of her over a pair of electric blue glasses. I realized with a start that the lenses were fake, and suppressed a smile. I nodded, and she handed me a broom.
"That's it? I'm hired?"
She snatched the broom out of my reach.
"Unless you don't want the job,
I want it."
"Good. Now, what are you doing tonight?"
"Tonight?" I blinked at her wide-eyed. The shelter had a curfew.
"Yes, tonight. You need to see the inside of a mall, stat."
"There are malls in Manhattan?"
"There are, but we're going to Jersey."
She shrugged.
"I live in Hoboken. There are malls there. You can stay with me."
"You just met me." I gave her a slitted-eye stare. A few months distanced from all that had happened in San Francisco, I was unaccustomed to common courtesy, downright wary of kindness.
"Call me crazy, or nice, or lonely."
She shrugged and unwrapped a dum-dum. She stuck out her hand, a ring on every finger.
"I'm Lydia."
"Are you new to the city?" I asked her, thinking of her or lonely. She furrowed her eyebrows.
"No, but everyone is lonely, right?"
She was arrestingly vulnerable, even while she was cutting you. You could just see people blink, unsure if she was putting them on. She winked her arm through mine.
"I have a feeling about you."
"I miss her. I miss her laughter, her unique, bitchy nice. I miss having a friend." In the coffee shop, I wait for cash, restless and fidgety. With a start, I realize then that I didn't get my call from Henry at 9 o'clock. There had been no envelope of cash on the counter this morning, no note, no "I'm sorry," nothing. I wonder if he's called the credit card company. These little money envelopes feel like a leash that he can take away at any time, and I'm left powerless. My face flushes at the thought. What would I have thought of an allowance 5 years ago? It would have been an extravagance. I text Henry's cell. "Are you okay? I'm sorry about our fight. Love you." I avoid saying I'm sorry for any specific thing, because I'm not sure that I am. But I struggle with being ignored. Everyone has fights, this I know. But our relationship feels cracked down the middle. Cash slides into the seat across from me with two paper cups and a tray of sandwiches, and I quickly tuck my phone into my purse, depressing the ringer down button.
"Can you ever pick a place with mugs, please?"
He flashes me a grin and I make a face at him. "Are you really too good for paper cups?" I peel off the plastic lid and let the curling steam escape.
"Hey, just because I scrape to make rent doesn't mean I don't enjoy the finer things in life."
He gently pushes a turkey sandwich in my direction. I smile and busy myself spreading mustard on the roll.
Are you still up for helping me? Tomorrow?
I am. What's your idea for a game plan?
Well, I can rent a car. I just want a navigator. I have no idea where I'm going. I have no idea what to expect when I get there. The turkey suddenly looks limp and slimy. Oh, God, tomorrow I'll meet my mother. It feels so weird to think about, to say. Because my whole life, my mother has been Evelyn, although I haven't called her mom since I was 15. The word mother gets twisted around on my tongue, snagged in its own connotations. Who is more my mother? Caroline, who birthed me and left me? Or Evelyn, who rescued me and raised me? Who bought me my first bra, taught me about love and sex, and later, death? Why are the words mother and love synonymous?
Expect the best, prepare for the worst?
Ha! That's a Henryism, I almost laugh.
He's a smart man.
We sit in silence for a moment while Cash chews. He dabs his mouth with a napkin and wipes a splotch of mayonnaise off the table.
Have you told him?
I shake my head, averting my eyes. I don't want to talk to Cash about Henry. I'm not naive. You don't talk to another man about your marriage. No, not yet. I will. He's been stressed about work lately. If it amounts to anything, I'll tell him.
What do you expect?
I don't know. Probably nothing? I feel the lie slip around my mouth. He nods and presses his forefinger into the tines of the fork.
It's okay to want something, Zoe. I knew a man back in Texas, dying of AIDS. He had no one, not one single person in the world who cared about him. His friends didn't know how to handle a sick guy, and this was in the late 90s. Anyway, he read my article and he called me, wanted to find his mother. Not his father, just his mother. He was raised by his father, a real son of a bitch. Anyway, it took me a few months and I was racing the clock with this guy. Finally, I found her. I had concrete proof that it was her. There was no doubt in my mind. There still isn't. Anyway, I called her. Explain the whole situation. I tell her that her son, her flesh and blood, is dying in hospice care not 50 miles from her house. Her response? She denies the whole thing. Says she never had a son, to never call her again. And hangs up on me. I kept calling for days. She never picked up the phone. He died a week later. I push away the tray. Why did you tell me this story? Cash taps the fork twice on the table. I don't know. I guess it's the one that stuck with me the most. The way you can deny your own child that way.
Right. You're not helping. He laughs.
I'm sorry. I have a bunch of wonderful reunion stories, too. Do you want me to tell you those?
No, it's okay. I'm fine. I guess my goal is just to have a connection. That's all. Just to know it's there. Somewhere in the world, someone knows I exist. That sounds overly dramatic, and I shake my head. Let's talk about the plan. I'll call the car service today and rent a car.
Don't bother. I have a car.
You live in Manhattan and have a car? On a reporter's salary? I tease and pick at a potato chip.
I'm secretly rich, but I find all my money repels the ladies.
He smirks at me.
No, seriously, it's a used Honda. I park it in my mother's garage. She lives in Queens. We can take the subway to her house and pick it up in the morning.
Cash pulls out his phone and maps the route. We'll meet at 8 at the train station. And I wonder for a brief second what I'll do when Henry calls at 9. If he calls. When Cash checks his watch and announces that his long lunch is over, I quell a stab of disappointment. With a quick tap on my hand and a "see you tomorrow," he's gone, and I'm left at the table alone. I think of the apartment, the shattered glass on the dining room floor that I haven't yet bothered to clean up, and I feel rooted to my seat. I picture Penny finding the sticky mess, wondering about its meaning, calling Henry, compassion in her voice. Are things okay? I rummage through my purse for my phone, which is blinking with a waiting text from Henry. Are you at home? I'm sorry about our fight. I've been hopelessly stressed about work. I want you in my life more than anything else. I forgot all about the celebration tonight. I've been so distracted. I love you. Please say you'll go with me. It's formal. I've sent something to the apartment. Call me when you get it.